Hello! Before we get into this week's episode, I just wanted to give you a little plug for the eLife Ambassadors programme. No, we're not being paid for this, though if eLife are listening, I'd not turn down paid adverts, because we really need to find some way to keep the lights on around here. Anyway, just want to plug this because it's a really great opportunity for early career researchers interested in greater openness, integrity and inclusion in science. If you want to know more, there's a webinar on the 27th of October and the deadline is the 7th of November. Links will be in the show notes, so get applying now. Seriously, pause this, go apply, come back and enjoy the episode. Hello and welcome to Preprints in Motion. Join us as we sit down with early career researchers and discuss their latest preprint and find out about their journey through the muddy marshes of academia. But we don't stop there. Every month we'll be bringing you special episodes with open science leaders where we discuss how to fix academia. Easy, right? So hit that subscribe button, leave a rating, or find us on Twitter at MotionPod. But for now, let's get into the show. This week we talked to postdoc Derek Lau about alpha-synuclein, Parkinson's disease, and being a new postdoc during the lockdown. Okay, so thank you so much for joining us. It's really good to get another neuroscience paper on the show. Generally, we found that we pick either immunology papers, it's my background, or we pick neuroscience papers, because that's Emma's background, occasionally throwing in some weird fly etymology stuff because of John. So, you know, this is hopefully something I'm becoming a bit more familiar with. And we're talking about Parkinson's disease today, which is really, really interesting. So I've done a little bit of, I learned about Parkinson's disease. I'm not an expert, but you are. So hopefully you can tell us a lot about it.
Well, thank you for Johnny and Emma for having me on the show. It's a great privilege to be here. Actually, I guess in my PhD, I wasn't really specialized in Parkinson's. Actually, my background was in HIV. And it was the technique that, you know, carried me over to working with Parkinson's disease, which is what my supervisors are working on. And for those who don't know much about it, I guess I'm brief as I can be. It's a neurodegenerative diseases, which I guess classically happens to all people as they age. And basically, the classical symptom is that they have like very uncontrolled hand tremors. And that comes from the cell death of what you call these dopamine neurons. Yeah, and what I guess in Parkinson's disease, the other features, a hallmark feature is when you look at these cells with patients who are diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, you have these inclusions in these cells known as a Lewy body. So, and these inclusions are packed with, until recently shown that it has a lot of lipids. But historically, the community we thought that it's really enriched in this protein called alpha-synuclein, in which the function is, still not very well characterized, but it is definitely in there. And this protein, when you make it in a test tube and try to purify recombinantly, it makes these fibrils. And these fibrils, these tangles are actually in this Lewy body. And I guess we are onto something. A lot of, the community are onto this Lewy body and alpha-synuclein and using that as a biomarker, essentially, for the progression of this disease.
So could you tell us just a little bit more about what alpha-synuclein is? Because it's primary part of what the preprint is about.
Sure. It's a very small protein. Basically, it's expressed in actually quite a lot of cells, to be honest. So, but it's mainly found is in these dopaminergic neurons. So I guess they are responsible in, motor movements and whatnot. This is why I guess when these cells die, you exhibit those Parkinson-like symptoms, essentially. And I guess normally this protein is typically unstructured, and in fact there's to date there's no structural crystallography structures on that protein per se, and generally appears as monomer, so it doesn't, it just is in those cells, and we think they are kind of relevant for dopamine release or trafficking. But to be honest, it's not so sure. Its mechanism is not fully elucidated yet. But what it has known is that at some point, as the individual ages, is this monomeric alpha-synuclein kind of eventually some trigger, whether it's reactive oxygen species. So basically the environment, some kind of environmental trigger caused them to, assemble into these fibrils and potentially trapping other proteins and making these aggregates and then forming this Lewy body, which is, the hallmark of Parkinson's diseases.
Do we know where the alpha-synuclein comes from in Parkinson's? Because it's upregulated, right, during Parkinson's disease?
Yes, I guess the At least from what I know, is the link for of alpha-synuclein into Parkinson is that they look at familial mutations. So there's some mutation like in certain part of the protein where I guess in those individuals they were more prone to develop Parkinson diseases. At the same time, they also look, I think it's from a genome-wide screen where they looked at individuals with Parkinson. They saw duplications, even triplication of these genes. So basically, the more of these genes, having more of this protein makes it express higher and more chance of developing the diseases. That's how the trend got picked up and how it's related.
Emma looked like she was going to jump in there.
I was, but then you said what I was going to say. Just I was just nodding along.
Yeah, we're in the rare situation where we have two experts on the topic today.
That's great. Great. I love criticism. I mean, I don't know everything, and in fact, I'm very open to if I say anything wrong, I don't take any word. I'm very open, so I don't believe I know everything, and I'm happy to learn things along the way.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say, if you were thinking about where it's come from, as we were talking before, like kind of off air, we were talking about the gut brain axis, and actually, the thought is actually alpha-synuclein can move in a prion-like fashion from enteric neurons in the gut up to the brain. So that's kind of, it's thought to predate the motor symptoms by about 10 years ish.
That's right. So I guess that's the thing I failed to share in the introduction. So when this environmental trigger happens, so you get this, I guess, this pathogenic form of alpha-synuclein, right? So they kind of now, they become the template, right? So they kind of speed things up by being the seed. And I guess that alludes a bit to my papers. They become the seed and they kind of make the recruitment of other, I guess, physiologically normal, normally folded functional alpha-synuclein to come with them. And they kind of then propagate, just much like the mad cow disease, I guess, as an example. So by having this seed, I guess, as Emma mentioned, so we don't know where these seeds start. And some people say start in the guts, that means your intestine. And then basically it crosses somehow into the spinal cord, which is where most patients are. So to look at to diagnosis is what they do. They look at the cerebrospinal fluid. So I guess I'm looking for these seeds in there. So that's how some of the classic assays are working at the moment. And then somehow it reaches the brain. So if it travels up the spinal cord from the gut, I mean, it could easily reach the brain and just cross the blood-brain barrier. So that's, yeah, I mean, I don't know that much of the mechanism, but that's what has been proposed for sure.
That's one of the things I find really interesting about Parkinson's is you can relate it to prion diseases, which themselves are super interesting, totally off topic. So I'm going to throw my knowledge in the arena here, because we had a nice discussion about all of this before we started recording and I felt very left out. So generally speaking, in all, you know, all diseases, all disorders, there is an underlying immune dysfunction component, usually inflammation. And that has I know it's got a role in Parkinson's disease, but I'm not super, I mean, it's not my area, I'm not super familiar with it. But do you know what is going on with the immune system here? Because with you mentioned these Lewy bodies and this buildup of things that aren't meant to be there, the immune system's going to come along and try and clear those, and that exacerbates problems.
To be honest, as much as I'm not a trained immunologist, so I don't want to say the wrong thing, at the moment, I haven't came up with any, I could be wrong, right? So I didn't came up anything involving T cell, memory T cell, whatnot. But there's definitely a lot of antibody works, actually, if it's relevant. Lots of biopharma company like looking for antibodies that targets disease, right? So just bind it and neutralize it. I guess if your question was whether there's specific, I guess, leukocytes that are engineered to look for them, I'm not sure for that, to be honest. I wouldn't be able to answer that for sure. Certainly, I could imagine having, you know, all your macrophages swarming up your brain looking for this, I guess, bad poison, if you would say, dopaminergic neurons. So I can't imagine how much inflammation that will cause, and I guess the effect could be bad. But just throwing out there, I mean, I don't know much about that per se.
I just thought I'd throw the immunology spanner.
Yeah,
in
of
there,
course, of so. Course. But there's definitely a lot of companies working in, you know, small compounds, small peptides. You're looking to, I guess, inhibit the propagation process. And yeah, antibodies has been, I guess, as close as immunology I could associate with, probably the closest I can think of in that aspect.
So from my limited knowledge as well on the immunology-based side of Parkinson's disease, maybe I'll go look it up a bit more after this, but one of the main causes is neuroinflammation generally, but that's just kind of like a toxic environment, right? From all the I guess the glial cells and the microglia and all of those immune response. But that's basically as much as I've really known. I know it's a main cause. I just don't know the underlying cellular basis for it.
Yes, it's a tricky environment, of course. So yeah.
So before I get back to the questions about the preprint, I've got another general question. So you've mentioned the fact that there's a potential link to your microbiota in your gut, which is one of those, again, it's one of those emerging fields which is seemingly involved in everything and is super interesting that I don't know all that much about. Mm-hmm. But what do we know in terms of, you know, is this one of those, well, very sort of Daily Mail journalist hat on here? Can we just eat some nice probiotic yogurts and cure ourselves?
I just don't want to be in the position to say something that's not true. I don't know much about microbiota per se. But I guess the only relevant I can think, like, I know about why Parkinson could originate from, like, the gut is, I guess, the symptoms associated with constipation. So I guess because the motor neurons are obviously not functioning properly, so they have difficulty, you know, passing the food in your stomach. So that's how they kind of alluded to that. So microbiota, I'm not so sure if it's, I don't know if yogurt would help solve that issue.
So I'll ask it a bit more seriously.
Okay.
So some of the microbiota studies have amazingly managed to say, you know, show that if you have a certain composition of gut bacteria, then that can be either beneficial or damaging. I mean, these are super complex studies, and it's obviously never going to be that simple in reality. But has anyone done that, do you know, for Parkinson's disease or any neuro disease, actually? I'm not sure.
Not that I've read. Not that I've read. So I wouldn't want to give wrong advice per se.
I just did a quick Google on this just to make sure I wasn't misquoting anything. And there's a study that's just been done, and I'll link it in the podcast notes or the show notes. But basically, they're saying that they did several studies, analyzed the gut microbiome in PD patients, but there wasn't like a consensus on the features of a PD specific microbiota that is like missing. I'll link it in the paper.
Is that the one I'm reading also? Is that by Nature Publishing Group, Parkinson's disease?
Yeah, it's 10th of March. Yeah.
Yes. I think I'm reading the very same one. Yes. It's interesting for sure. I mean, microbiota is so huge, right? Like it's a big field in itself. Like there's so many different bugs that are healthy for you. So you need to do quite a bit of work to just dissect which ones can help, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not easy. Well, there you go. Live reporting just there. Aren't we professional? So back to the preprint. Let's get back on track, I guess. So you've been looking at alpha-synuclein, and you've been doing some single molecule profiling. So this is not something that I've come across very often. So could you explain what single molecule profiling is and how you went about it?
Of course. So I guess this stems from my work in PhD. I'm very interested in... In fact, I've always been interested in doing microscopy. Stemming from my one of my PhD chapters, so where I basically used the very same technique to look at protein-protein interaction with HIV, the capsid, which is a shell. So that technique is called single molecule spectroscopy. And what single molecule means, you can actually look at, a reaction, an interaction, but like down to the very single molecule level. And that you can do so, and that is in contrast to bulk reading. So what you call bulk reading, for example, a plate reader. So when you read a fluorescence or something that's in bulk, so it's the whole solution, but average, right? With a single molecule, you kind of have a bit more, the best word is granularity, right? So you can go a bit closer, like you shrink that volume down to a very, very small volume. And that can be achieved because, you know, the lens can focus to one point, right? And that point is known as the confocal volume. So when it focuses at that point until it can't focus anymore, you still have a very small volume there, which is approximately 1 femtoliters, I believe. So when molecule crosses in that confocal volume, and if it has the right fluorophore, and your microscope, your confocal is now operating in confocal mode, has the right laser that's compatible with the fluorophore, so it emits light, and that is captured. So essentially, you're able now to resolve small things in solution that you otherwise cannot see in bulk. That's essentially, I guess, in a nutshell, if I put it that way.
So it's a bit like RNA-seq v single cell RNA-seq, then, I guess.
Something like that. I guess, like, looking at, I don't know, I guess you guys are all known, you know more than me, I guess, flow cytometry. I guess instead of looking at the entire...
Sorry.
Do you, Emma? I don't know. Do you guys use that technique?
Emma likes it, but Emma doesn't do real force cytometry.
I do like force cytometry. I do a very basic. I just look for like GFP tag proteins and don't do massive sets of like different antibodies and have to kind of work it all out. I just kind of go, we see expression of GFP. We don't.
but let's imagine for a second. So you can either have a readout for your plate of culture dish, or you can just sort the cells out, and that's the sorting kind of like gives more granularity, right? So this is I guess single cell approach, single molecule approach, yeah. kind of equivalent, if I have to put into perspective.
So I guess one of the big benefits of that is that you can kind of detect heterogeneity more, right? You can detect quite granular differences between, and you're doing this it's not the cell level, it's the molecule level.
Yes, that's right. Well, molecule level, aggregate level at the moment. Yeah. So yeah.
So is that something that can, in the the context of what you're doing, can that lead to earlier detection of Parkinson's disease?
Yes. So Emma earlier mentioned that the problem what we see at, like for diagnosis of Parkinson's is usually when the person is diagnosed, which is already quite a difficult thing because so much symptoms overlap with other illnesses. It would be quite late in the progression and difficult to reverse. I mean, you could put them on treatment like to slow it down, but it will be, quite late. So I guess having this tool in hand that our lab has developed will enable us to, see things, with much smaller, concentration because we have this now high sensitivity. So we were hoping, we could be used to, for early detection because as soon as you have very little quantity, you're able to say, yep, that person has it. Whereas in bulk, you most likely won't be able to see it until very late stage.
So this is, you mentioned, you're looking at this down a microscope. Obviously, we can't benefits of mice versus humans here. With a human, you can't just put a microscope on their brain and have a look at them. They won't like that very much. So in your introduction to the paper, you mentioned two techniques that can detect alpha-synuclein in biofluids. So is this, this is ultimately where you're kind of working towards, right? You want to be able to take a sample from a patient and then detect these kind of things.
That's correct. So we are working towards that. And my supervisors, so Dr. Jan Gambin and Dr. Emma Saraki, I think they probably have been cooking something in the background. I wasn't sure, but we're definitely moving towards that direction. And I guess that is what always keeps me excited, actually, like having, I get the privilege to touch clinical sample is always a something new to me. I haven't tried, especially I've always been working, recombinant protein in my candidates so far. So having access to clinical sample, I think it's a great privilege. For sure, we are working towards that. And that would be great, actually, because as I mentioned before, like the only way to diagnose Parkinson's disease, or at least what I can see, even it's not FDA approved yet, but you got this bulk assay, so when I say bulk, because that's what it is, and to detect them, you kind of use CSF, which I mentioned is cerebral spinal fluid that you get from lumbar spine, and to get that is actually quite, I would say, in my perspective, quite invasive, and of course, for longitudinal studies to, to look at progressions of the disease or even see if the drug works, you wouldn't want to be shoving needles every once or so often, and, especially not something which is quite sterile and aseptic, right, in your spine, so, yeah, definitely a test or to, look at validation on other biofluid like blood, saliva, things like that, or urine, for example, would greatly make would make more sense, I would say.
Have you seen any papers that have looked at blood, like successfully looked at alpha-synuclein in blood?
There was one that was I should have read it, but I haven't yet. They did look at, I think, urine, I believe, but I just haven't read in detail.
No, that's right. It was just my pile.
We all have a long, long pile
yes,
of papers.
We have a long list, and there's always, and I'm sure my supervisor would say, shouldn't you be doing all the reading in the lockdown, which is what is happening in Sydney at the moment. So I always find other, constructive procrastination.
Yeah.
I'm sure they don't want me saying that. They're going to be listening for sure.
It's okay. Yeah. We all do it. I think it is a vital part of getting through the day sometimes.
Yes. I guess that's all part of the research experience, right? You just see something interesting and you just follow that.
We have a friend who he basically works 11 till like 4.
Oh my goodness.
I don't think he listens very often, so I'm okay saying all this about him. And if he does, I don't care. He very much believes in having regular coffee breaks and has been known to have multiple hour-long coffee breaks a day. So I'm not entirely sure how he does any work.
But he does well.
But he has just submitted a paper, and it's really cool. So you know, clearly he does do work sometimes.
I mean, maybe he's just very talented and just...
Oh, don't say that. His ego does not need to be made any bigger.
You got to give him props.
Yeah, like, it's true. Yeah.
Nah, we don't.
I think that might be, could be natural talent.
So in this preprint, you've designed a 3D print attachment called Atoprite. So I'm going to come back to just 3D sort of deep printing stuff in general, but could you tell us a little bit about Atoprite, sort of what it is, what it does?
Oh, sure. I actually wasn't the one, I guess, that brought it to life, if I should say. So it was actually a former postdoc working in the same group, actually, that worked together with, I guess, a senior RA. His name is Dr. James Brown, actually Mr. Akshay Bamkar. So they are the one that actually published the design in Nature Communication, I believe. So, and I guess if I was to, I guess, give a bit more of a description on what the machine is, it's a very, very small portable device. So the objective there was to make this technique, single molecule spectroscopy, more accessible to others. So we kind of, at least my supervisor was also the idea as well, is to make it like, you know, printable. So with 3D printing becoming more accessible these days and more affordable. So we could just print these and build this microscope with just the, you know, the basic components. So we just have like a laser, which is compatible with a fluorophore. Like if you want just single color detection of your fluorophore, you just have one avalanche shorter diodes. So that's like a detector to capture the light emitted. And you have a few cleanup mirrors and there you go. And it's very portable. It's like, I don't know, what size is it looking at? It's a very small device. We have a photo for the figure there, but it's as small as a PC tower that you buy from Dell. So it's a very small thing. You just plug in and just calibrate it and there you go. And I guess one of the mission for having, I guess, a 3D printed devices, like I said, so accessibility was one, but we also wanted to design it to be friendly for analysis, so to able to be used in other labs without, you know, too much expertise. And I guess the background is for those kind of system, like real, like hardcore, real, like confocal microsystem, they have to be, you know, like very expensive maintenance and other things. And you also need like specialist offices to maintain them, right? So we want to kind of remove all this agency and just, you know, keep it nice, essential and simple.
So, you know, with it being 3D print, is this available to download online as the design?
Oh, yeah, it is. Yeah. I think everything is all open. I guess it's open access in the NatureCom. Happy to share the article, but just look for James Brown. But yeah, essentially, you should be able to find it really easily. Yeah, it's 2019, so it was 2 years ago. Have a read. If you guys are 3D printed AutoCAD people, I'm sure you're able to open the file. You should be able to just print it really quickly and build your own. Just reminds me, actually, because I was just listening to one of Preprints in Motion podcasts. Very similar, I guess, the logic of the Lego microscope, which is, I believe, is your first episode.
It was our first episode.
Yes. So I guess our vision is more like towards that person. So scientists we're working with. So
I do like that. I mean, obviously, you know, 3D printing, it's not a new thing anymore, but it's becoming more normal and it's becoming cheap enough that, you know, as a lab, you can buy a 3D printer. I mean, certainly in America, there's a few cases I know where labs have their own 3D printer and they'll do things like they'll print test tube racks up and stuff because they cost. So I don't know if anyone listening or on this call has ever ordered test tube racks. They're expensive.
Oh, they're very expensive.
They're very expensive.
Everything that slaps with Thermo Fisher, Merck, the premium just goes up by 200%.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
This is magical. This is the magic of marketing and branding, right? So,
yeah, you know, like making these things is just so much cheaper. And I think every university should do that because you save so much money.
I think so too. I totally think so too.
So it is really nice that this is our second time where we're actually talking to somebody who's actually actively doing something like this. It's really good.
Thank you.
So I can skip my next question. We've already asked it. So alpha-synuclein, you mentioned that this can aggregate. And when it does this, this essentially forms sort of a fingerprint. And you can use that to identify the subspecies of alpha-synuclein. Why is it important to identify the subspecies? Do different species of alpha-synuclein have sort of worse pathologies?
So I guess this is where we're trying to kind of delineate. I guess most of the model would always say you have the monomer, then you have kind of make into these oligomers. And these oligomers are quite pleomorphic, right? There's different shape, there's different reactivity. Throwing mutation gets more complicated. But then from the oligomers, you get these short fibrils. and then it rearranged to more beta sheet, and then eventually it will get into very long filaments. So we want to examine, you know, like which one of are these oligomers. Like no one has, from our knowledge, has seen that oligomers are, even though they're the intermediates, like are they all, you know, seeding competent? Like can they grow? Can they all act the same? And I guess this is where we bring our sensitivity, right? We're able to, you know, sort them, and not only see them, but we're able to kind of sort them. And we can kind of, so I guess first part of the figure is we're able to, you know, track them as they grow over a period of 5 hours, which in the scope of things, you know, I mean, a lot of experiment kind of make fibro, they kind of shake them for days. And we're just looking at the first 5 hours, right? I bet we're doing very high concentration, which is quite standard, you know, what has been done. But we look in the first 5 hours, we're already seeing, you know, a tons of heterogeneity. So we've got fibrils, we've got short filaments, very, you know, round oligomers, a bit of everything. So that's why I guess the next follow-up, we want to, you know, separate them and just look at them individually and compare them essentially. And I guess the scientific question is more, you know, can we use these, now this, we have this profile, once we sort them, we look at this profile, can we now allocate them? Okay, if a person kind of have this biofluid and we see this pattern, is he at the risk of the early stage of Parkinson's disease or not? Hmm. So could that be an important fingerprint? So that's where we're kind of heading towards, I guess.
And this, so, you know, the method you've got working now and you've developed, is this something you use to look at other aggregates in Parkinson's disease? Because alpha-synuclein is not the only one.
At the moment, not really. We just have the construct. And since I started my postdoc a little bit, I would say maybe a year, a little bit over a year. So in that field, I haven't got the chance to touch other things yet. Mm. Definitely there has been occasion where collaborators has been sending us tau-4 repeats. So I guess that one's for Alzheimer's disease. So we had a bit of playing with those, but obviously my hands were full on that assay, so didn't really touch that one. I mean, there's a lot of interesting things to explore, like crosstalk and like could that see the other? I mean, comorbidity of Alzheimer's and Parkinson. I mean, so much to explore, but so little time as always. So I haven't yet, but certainly there'll be, I'm sure, maybe down the line.
And so what about sort of adapting this to larger scale? Because, you know, ultimately we want to detect Parkinson's earlier, and this is one potential way of doing that. So how adaptable is it to sort of high throughput?
I would say it's pretty high throughput. So in terms of timing, we read a sample, one sample can be read every 10 minutes. So I run 6 traces of 100 seconds, that's 600 seconds, 10 minutes. So I guess in 1 hour, you could run 6, in 2-3 hours, you could run 18. So you run 18 a day, I would say, negative plus positive. Yeah, I would say probably can run 18, 20 sample a day comfortably, I would say. And then if you want to stay for longer, you should certainly run more and just do in tandem and just kind of like shift it. So you can certainly, I mean, it's pretty easy. On the, I guess the longest from, I guess the bottleneck is usually acquisition because it's like 10 minutes. The analysis is really automated. So we already have a script that is already developed by our friend, it's a French intern that came to our lab, Chloe Magnon. So she actually developed the script and from Python against open source. And what that does, it goes in now, traces, and just get all the parameters, the single molecule parameters, and then you can just quickly plot them. And all that's done, you know, in an automated, very objective manner. So the analysis is quite fast, I wouldn't say slow. Mm. And then you can leave more time for interpretation for that way. But yeah, the analysis is really fast and easy to use, friendly as well.
And there is an excellent plug for every lab having a coder. They are incredibly beneficial and hugely underestimated.
Yeah, I tried learning coding, but I guess it's a different language and just easily switched off. And C++, you got so many different languages. Yeah.
It's difficult. I learned R just before the first lockdown. Well, started learning before the first lockdown and was very lucky to then get involved in a project where we had some like R experts who I just constantly bother with questions every time I do something because I always forget what I've... Because you don't use it like constantly. I never remember how to do basic things. So yes. They're always helping me out.
I feel like, yeah, definitely understand your, I guess, your feeling. Like usually like you want to learn something and as soon as you don't practice it, you kind of forget.
Yeah.
I think it goes with any techniques, right? So
yeah.
Like unless you really use it all the time, you can quite easily forget. There are always going to be, you know, easy ways. Like you say, ask some colleague, hey, can you help me? And they're always like nice chaps and just give you a hand. Just a stone throw away.
So Emma, have you got any more sciencey questions to ask?
No, I think you answered you because I wrote the questions. I think you've asked everything that I was interested in.
I think I've stuck to them all.
Yeah. Well done, Johnny.
I mean, I still went off topic and threw my own in there, but I think I actually, this might be the first time I've asked every question Emma's written. I try. I really do try.
I think you're doing fantastic.
So we'll keep that bit in.
Where do I find out about the different bioarchive licenses? This CC, BY, CDXY nonsense is driving me nuts.
ASAP Bio have a resource for that.
Ugh, that's your answer to everything.
That's because they have everything you need to know about preprints.
Sure, they probably have the basics, like info on the preprint servers, but what else is there?
There's so much more. Looking to post a preprint, but not sure what different journal policies are? They have a collection to help you out with that. There are meetings around preprints and associated services. If you want to know how preprint adoption has changed over time, there's even a page on that.
And COVID?
They have a big section on preprints and the pandemic, plus some really cool infographics for communicating preprints.
And university policies? Surely they don't have that.
They collect uni policies where possible.
Okay, they do sound pretty impressive, but is it not a bit of an echo chamber?
It can be, but ASAP Bio also engage with people who don't love preprints and have concerns. So we had an excellent discussion on this very topic a couple of months ago.
Oh, is there anything ASAP Bio don't do?
Honestly, no, they're so nice over there. They were so quick to jump in and support this show. It's your one-stop shop for info on preprints and open science initiatives. So head over to asapbio.org to learn more and subscribe to their newsletter for the latest in preprint news. If you want a deeper dive into the world of preprints, then look out for the next recruitment of ASAP Bio Fellows.
So, I mean, you mentioned that you're a relatively new postdoc. You're just over a year. I'm also just over a year into technically my second postdoc, but we don't talk about the first one because I'd probably get into trouble if I did. So, you know, how are you finding being a postdoc, particularly because, you know, as you mentioned, you are in lockdown at the moment and Australia has been quite tough on the lockdown. So have you managed to get into the lab a lot?
Yeah, it has. The answer is no. We pretty much reduced to very few people. I believe our deans took, I guess, the lockdown restriction quite seriously and for good reason. I think it just protects our community, just keep everybody safe until our state ramps up with the vaccination rate, which is going very promising. So at the moment, I wasn't able to gain the access. So most of the time, like I say, read the preprint, the reviewer came back with the comments, and I was just, I guess before this, I was just working with the rebuttal and how to explain and clarify a few issues there. So working on that, doing some readings here and there, just try to keep busy from that time. Yeah, so that's what I've been doing lately.
So how have you found being a postdoc compared to being a PhD student? Admittedly, it's going to be a bit weird with lockdown, but...
Yeah, so I definitely feel it's kind of similar. Definitely, you get more freedom to work on a project. The supervisor has more, I guess, faith. You're more autonomous. You try to keep yourself motivated, and it's kind of similar, but then you got a bit more advanced intellectual, which is what you get after graduating, right? So more hands-off kind of thing, and then you just have to deliver and just push yourself to deliver, you know, deadline that you set yourself. I think that's it. That's the difference. And yeah, I think that's the only difference I can see.
Are you enjoying being a postdoc?
I am at the moment because I got so much to look forward to. So like, I guess the work at the moment, it's just lockdown's really not helping.
Yeah.
And you can't really blame anybody per se. I'm looking forward to I guess that, like I mentioned previously, the clinical translation aspects, so being able to touch clinical sample. And I think this would help me, I guess, even if I ever decide to transition to industry, because I mean, clinical knowledge is always good. Like, I've been looking at roles like medical science liaison that uses that kind of skill, right? So I guess having some clinical knowledge could be helpful if I ever decide to go there. Just keep yourself, you know, open for that. Another thing I was looking forward to is, since I'm a big fan of microscopy, I'm really looking forward to do some cryo transmission electron microscopy. And yeah, and where I'm working, I have this fantastic trainer, Dr. Nicholas Ariotti. He's fantastic. He's been teaching me a lot of stuff. So definitely waiting for that opportunity just to make it, you know, scientifically sound to start to learn that technique. So just waiting for that. A lot to look forward to.
So our friend I mentioned earlier did some electron microscopy stuff, and he loved it. And actually, as a group, we quite like our microscopes. That's Sheffield for you. It's instills microscopes. My whole project is heavily microscopy based, and it's so much fun.
Is it cells? I guess it's like microsectioning and things
so,
like that.
So right? Some of it is looking at cells, so more sort of traditional confocal stuff, but we also do a lot of IVM, so intravital microscopy.
Right. Those ones, yes.
Can't remember what I do these days. So we do a lot of intravital microscopy, and that's something I've wanted to learn for years. It's really cool.
That's like looking in the mouse, right? Like you have the mouse kind of semi-asleep.
Yeah, so you knock your mouse out, and what we do is we look at how immune cells cross through like veins and arteries and stuff. So basically you put your mouse in the microscope and you've got an exposed muscle in this case, and you just see the blood flow, and it that alone is super cool to sit and watch. I could sit and watch that for hours. I love it.
I can understand. That's why I want to just say this, like I kind of more in the camp like seeing is believing.
Yeah.
So having to see through a lens like with your eyes, and I guess being the first one kind of gives you the joy of being a researcher, right? You're the first one to see things. So it's really cool.
And there's things you just you can't ever do unless you look at it and see it, or things you would never think of unless you see it. There's some really cool examples where that's happened. So what one of the other transitions you have done is that you went from HIV to Parkinson's disease. So you've kind of crossed from immunology to neurology. And as we were talking about off mic, cool proper technical term there for you all, I assume. Those two fields are traditionally sort of the most complex in the biosciences. So I mean, why, I guess, is the question. Why would you do that to yourself?
Out of interest. I knew, I guess, coming out of PhD and from my supervisor, who has been lovely mentor to me, so Associate Professor Till Bocking, kind of gave me kind of advice once I graduated. He said, doing a postdoc, you would usually want to, either you maintain a bit of your technique and learn something totally new to inspire yourself, or you stay in the same field but kind of learn new techniques. So it's either one way or the other. So I guess when I graduated with the COVID, I was kind of looking more a job locally. Remember, just to went to, I mean, did consider US. In fact, I had a fantastic professor from the US that kind of offered me a job, but I had to decline politely. So just because various personal issues, but of course, like the COVID being one of the reason, and I just wanted to wear it die down. So picked up this application with my current supervisors, and same technique, different field. So I said, why not explore something new? And I got that clinical side, which I'm whetting my appetite. So I definitely want to explore that.
I mean, that's actually probably really good advice to PhD students because I've never thought of it like that, but it is, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, he's fabulous. So yeah, my supervisor is really supporting. I just can't thank him enough for that.
And one of the things most of us don't get to do is come anywhere near clinical samples. Most of our research, we're kind of stuck on, to be honest, topics that are quite esoteric. It's sometimes hard to explain why what you're doing is important to the general public, because why would people care if you're looking at something that doesn't have any clinical relevance? Which, of course, there's always really good reasons for doing this. But so I guess you mentioned a few times now that it's kind of one of those things that is something that's really good to look forward to. Was that one of the big reasons you wanted to start on this kind of thing?
One of the big reasons, for sure. I mean, also the other thing, I guess, like option obviously to go to industry. And at that time I looked, Australia, again, like I said, Australia is not very big on in terms of the job market. At least that's how I felt. And the US, definitely a lot of the application would ask for 2, 3, 4 years of industry experience. And just coming out, I didn't really feel that confident, let's be honest. So I would be pitched against the same guys in the States that has accumulated mountains more experience than me. So I say 1 or 2 year postdocs and see if something I like, and I find something I like, keep going and see how far I can go.
That is also a good outlook. A lot of people kind of fix themselves on, I want my own lab and I'm doing everything I can to get to it, and then they kind of realize how difficult and awful that can sometimes be, and then kind of they don't seem to know what else to do. So I think it's really good to have quite an open attitude when you're certainly at the start of scientific careers.
There's a quote that I wasn't taught, but it was in high school. My maths teacher, his name was Mr. Box, actually. He's really fun to be with. And he has on this wall, plastered in his wall, he said, it's written, if you try, you may fail. But if you don't try, you are guaranteed to fail. So since we've been given opportunities, you know, just take it and give it a go. Give it your best and see where it leads you. Keep the doors open.
Oh, that would be a good place to end, but I have more questions.
We can always take it offline, but yeah, so good.
Whose decision was to preprint this work? Is this, you know, is this something you've thought about a lot, or was this a supervisor decision?
So it's, I would say supervisor's decision, for sure. But I have sent to preprint during my PhD candidature, so I'm not entirely new at this process, I guess. Especially not at BioArchive, because it was the same platform that I submitted my, I think it was my first author paper, so that was put in BioArchive. And I think it's really interesting, that moment, and I didn't know about that kind of, I guess, service publishing, I guess, aspect in academia until, you know, when I put it up there. And certainly I, to be honest, I felt a bit uneasy, not because it wasn't right. I mean, it's out there. I mean, you have like a lot of, I guess, colleagues saying, oh, you could be scooped. And I think that you covered a bit in some previous episode about why preprint, right? So there's what that aspect. And there's also like, okay, so you have this preprint sitting there. Is it scientifically reviewed, validated? I mean, anyone can just post anything, especially in the current COVID period. You know, you get these predatory anti-vaxxers or whatever. They can always be opportunistic and take whatever you publish. Take, for example, the malaria drug that was controversial. So yeah. Things like that. So it always opens, you know, kind of risk and benefit, right? So I'm a bit of a mixed bag. But for sure, like for this one, that for this single molecule paper on alpha-synuclein, was my supervisor that uploaded.
Yeah, I mean, you're hitting on topics there that I know quite a lot about, because we've looked at it. But I'm not going to keep plugging my own work, because I feel like I do that way too much on here. Nobody needs to hear any more about my COVID work. I'm sure you've all read the papers and couldn't care less anymore by now. So I feel like I ask this question every episode, but I ask it because it's really interesting to sort of get people's opinions on why they've done it and what their experience is with it. One of my fantastic co-authors, Nick Fraser, he recently posted a preprint that, I mean, I'm sure it'll come out as a paper soon, where they did a survey of BioArchive authors to find out sort of their reasonings for posting preprint and stuff. And actually, a lot of what you've said fits quite nicely into what they found. And I always find it interesting that it's often, with at least with the people we've spoken to, it's usually the supervisor's decision to do it, which is surprising, because, I keep saying this like every episode, I'm sure everyone's sick of hearing it, but one of the best things about preprint is that it benefits us more than anyone else. You know, it's the Erica researchers are the ones who really gain from preprinting the work. And I'm always surprised by how it's not us pushing that as much as I expect it to be.
I guess in hindsight, I would say definitely it's good to have a conversation with your supervisor, manager. So I guess you give a bit of that respect. That's just how I feel, right? So give him that respect, because it's his work, it's his idea, it was his conceptualization, so you kind of want to respect him and say, hey boss, like, are you okay to put that on there? If he wants, great. If he doesn't, maybe give some room to understand, like, okay, that could be a very risky project, we want to shoot high and just keep it low for a little bit. And I mean, I would take that as a valid reason. And then I guess after hearing that reasoning, I guess it would be okay to let go. But definitely having that conversation would be quite helpful, and then you can also, like you say, you explain, oh, it would be good for my career, like to see, you know, what I have done. If I'm moving to another lab, for example, it would be great to have that. And I'm sure great supervisors out there, if they're ever listening, they would understand that, you know, what's good for, you know, his or her employees, I would have to assume, like, also be good for them, right?
Yeah.
In the long run. So it's good to have that conversation.
It is. Sure. And it's, you know, it's, I think it's good to bring your point across that it is beneficial for you, it's beneficial for the lab. And I think that is a really important point. Mm. And I think that's another good point to end, actually. That seems like a nice ending point. I've got no more questions. I'm out of questions.
No, that seems like...
Anything else?
No. Do you want to plug the Nature thing again?
Oh, yeah. Thank you. I see I'd forgotten. Sorry, John. More editing. So for anyone who hasn't come across this yet, although if you're active on Twitter, it's probably very difficult to have not come across this yet. Nature News published a series, I think it was 4 articles, a couple of days ago. And they followed 2 amazing scientists who started their labs up in Sheffield University in the UK.
Yeah,
They're PIs now, yeah. So it was Dan Bowles and Ali 12 Trees. They started as I was leaving Sheffield. So I met Dan a couple of times and I've chatted to Ali a little bit on Twitter.
Yeah, I worked with Ali a bit.
Yeah, they're lovely. But basically it's tracking their journey as new PIs, as they sort of start their labs and the difficulties of starting a lab. It's a very brutally honest piece. Dan and Ali are very, very honest in it, which is unfortunately rare, I think, in academia. Not everyone is willing to be so upfront about the real experience. But it's just a really, really good piece of reporting. It's quite a gripping read. There's twists in there you don't see coming. So if anyone has not seen that, go and read it. It'll be in the show notes because Emma's now going to have to dig it out.
I'm looking now.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to read it, so please share. So
it is just an excellent piece, and everyone should read it. And it's generated a huge amount of discussion on Twitter about the academic career structure and how awful it is and how we really, really need to reform the system as it is. Who was it? I can't remember who it was. Somebody on Twitter is now starting up Somebody on Twitter has started up a working group to sort of investigate this and try and get across these things to the funding bodies. So I've just opened Twitter and it's the first thing that's popped on Twitter. There you go. Oh, I'll find it later. But yeah, there you go. There was the plug.
Okay.
Well, hey, thank you so much for coming on. That was a really interesting discussion.
Thank you, Johnny. Thank you, Emma, for having me. It was a great privilege.
Yeah, it was lovely to have you. I really, really enjoyed having you on. I mean, I guess that's because it's kind of related to what I do as well. So I'm just quite keen to
listen. Yeah, it's good to have conversations with like-minded individuals. Very rare opportunity, especially in this lockdown. Yeah. Very, very good. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Okay, and that is the show. If you enjoyed listening, then hit that subscribe button for more and leave us a review on whatever platform it is you're listening on. You can reach out to us on Twitter at MotionPod or online at preprintsinmotion.com. Didn't enjoy that? Well, we're all scientists here, so send us your review and let us know what works or what you'd like to hear more of, or less of. But until next time, have a good week.